talk about the what we discussed in the strong gravity breakout group yesterday.
Okay, well,
as you speak, it's being broadcast around the world.
No, no, you're not lying. You're being immortalized, but you're not lying. Well, I want to edit this thing before I put it on the web. Seriously, the topic of our discussion group was this question of whether GR is a valid non-gravitational field. And we started off with Doug Irby, I suppose, addressing the question of what evidence is there from the theoretical side that gravity might not be that given by general relativity in strong fields. I think the conclusion of this talk was that black holes are absolutely airless. It kind of astonished me not only how simple they are, but how resistant they are to having any other properties put onto them in the face of quite different theories. So black holes are characterized by these very simple properties. Without a horizon,
appear to produce too much energy. There needs to be an absorbing boundary condition at the inner edge. So ADAP is probably good evidence, or at least carries the promise of providing excellent evidence for the existence of these properties of black holes, that it has escape velocity greater than light and absorbs everything. Can it map space-time geometry quantitatively, however? That's something that hasn't been looked into. Then we heard quite a bit about the accretion disks. Accretion disks are wonderful and very frustrating. We heard that they show extremely rich structure, and that structure presumably reflects the structure of space-time in the neighborhood. But the association of observation and theory is non-trivial. Perhaps the simplest and most straightforward observation is the iron line, in which time average profile shows a very strong gravitational redshift. So we're looking deep into the gravitational well there. There are astrophysical ambiguities, notably the mass scales out almost completely. You can't tell the mass by looking at the spectrum. Another ambiguity is that it appears that you can't tell whether the black hole is Schwarzschild or Kerr, although that statement depends a little bit on what matter is doing inside the innermost stable orbit. Reverberation mapping has the promise of resolving these questions. There's also Stefan-Boltzmann's determination of the inner radius, which is promising, but depends on similar questions. We heard a lot about quasi-periodic oscillations, which are a great observable. They show many frequencies, some with recognizable patterns. Some of the frequencies are stable under different sorts of conditions. And the question is, can those frequencies, these QPOs, be associated with this space-time structure? Well, disco seismology offers the ability to calculate the frequencies of those features. Again, you need harmonics to identify features with particular modes. When steering precession, again, you need these harmonics. It sounds like the observational situation with linear theory precession is not promising at the moment, but the theoretical feeling is quite good. There are some issues. For example, magnetic instability can tilt the disk in neutron stars, which is required to produce the linear theory precession, but there doesn't appear to be a mechanism for disk tilt in black holes. There are theories of orbiting blobs. We need a theoretical model for creation and survival. And there's some interesting work on constant scattering near the black hole, in which the main issue seems to be the question of whether the observations can be inverted to understand the actual space-time structure. So we have this quite a few observables, but which in principle can be inverted to measure the mass and spin of the black hole. In principle, if several of those different measurements coincide, that would provide support for the theory and possibly test VR. So here we have quite complicated observations. The question is, can we disentangle space-time structure from those? And I think Bob Wagner will talk about the rest of the session.
Equivalence of accelerations of the moon.
discuss scalar tensor theories as the simplest alternative, simplest viable alternative to general relativity, because now we go to stronger field systems, okay, and this formalism no longer holds, and there is no general formalism, so we just have to look at a different theory, and this is the currently popular alternative. The massless version only has one free function, okay, involving the spin zero field, involved with the spin two field in the metric coupling, okay, and to matter. So matter only feels this combination of spin two and spin zero through some effective metric tensor. Okay? And many of us work with an expansion of this function about its present cosmological average value by naught. In anticipation that these coefficients will be small, which, as you'll see, this one turns out to be. Okay, now these theories are interesting because in neutron stars, the scalar field can get strong enough if beta naught, the curvature of this effective coupling potential, is negative, then you get spontaneous scalarization. Gamora and others have looked at this. Spontaneous scalarization when large scalar fields build up in a neutron star. On the other hand, if you have positive curvature, then as Gamora and Norquist first showed, the universe evolves based on the minimum in this potential, just like an inflation falls down this potential, just like a ball in a potential well with bubble friction. The universe evolves and tends toward the minimum, of course. The minimum is where the effective coupling constant is zero, so it approaches general relativity. A natural explanation for why this number will turn out to be small today. Okay. These two coefficients are directly related to these fields to these two coefficients. And I'll illustrate that a little bit later. Okay. Binary pulsar tests were next discussed, which many of you are familiar with, involving Perry-Esten shifts, second-order Doppler gravitational wave shifts, orbital decay, and in one of these three systems, we now have three binary pulsars, which are contributing to tests of general relativity. In one of them, you have observable Shapiro time delay as well, but the restrictions on theory are not great. The bottom line is that it doesn't restrict alpha, zero, it does restrict beta zero to be in this range. But if in the future we get lucky and we see a pulsar with a black hole, especially if the orbit's almost edge on, we could get much better limits on the other parameter here, which is related to the gamma parameter directly. Present test primordial nucleosynthesis. Also, facts that the expansion rate of the universe is proportional, roughly speaking, to the square root of the effective gravitational constant, a function of the scalar field, to today's value of the gravitational constant, or in scalar field language, proportional to E to this A of phi, this coupling function, directly affects the expansion rate of the universe. Okay. If that's greater than 1, you get more helium in the early universe, the universe is expanding faster. That gives a very strong limit on these scalar tensor theories. But it only keeps the solar system limits for betas greater than 1. We've only investigated in the more also up to betas of order this large. So I don't know what the answer is for larger curvatures. So this is a natural range for positive curvatures. The limits now, and here's the relationship between the scalar field parameter, the coupling constant alpha zero, and the TPM parameter. Okay? And so, remember, this was a few parts in 10 to the 4 from the solar system. Okay? A few parts in 10 to the 4. You get 10 to the minus 9 limit, okay, in a flat universe. Zero cosmological constant, and somewhat weaker limits in a low density universe with zero cosmological constant, just to give some examples. confirm what your synthesis is, or those are wrong numbers. Next, we went on to gravitational waves, which are also, of course, involved in the binary pulsar test. because the scalar waves affect the orbits for the binary pulsars. But talking about LIGO and Virgo in the near future, okay? Prospects for direct detection of scalar waves are suppressed because scalar waves coupled to the detector with this coupling constant alpha zero, which you saw from the various tests, is less than a percent, less than a couple percent alpha zero. Scalar radiation, a big compute, is its effect on the coalescing binary orbit. The effects are small, very small, and don't give any new limits on these parameters in the theory. But in principle, they do affect the orbit through the energy loss of the reaction. They do affect the orbit of the coalescing binary. Okay? Next, Kip talked about prospects for LISA, the interferometer in orbit around the Sun near the Earth, which will look at much lower frequencies, of course, than here, millihertz instead of hundreds of hertz. The best test, which Kip focused on, is test particles, white dwarf, usually, neutron star, always, small black hole, always, test particle, orbiting into a medium supermassive black hole. This is in the best LISA band. Estimates for the event rate are maybe up to a few per year at 1 gigaparsec. Signal is strong from these. Kip and his group have analyzed equatorial orbits, the equatorial plane of the curved black hole, and they're in the process of investigating more general orbits, which are much more difficult. They're not chaotic, but they're close to chaotic. This is an interesting theoretical project. Well, accretion disk drag is probably small, and the real excitement is, it looks like we'll be able to measure many multiple moments of the black hole. Okay? And that leads into the theoretical project that came up in the session. The analog of the parameterized post-Newtonian formalism for black holes. Develop such a formalism. Okay? Take the mass and current multipoles, okay, that are inherent in the Vacuum-Einstein equations. Okay? Parameterize them relative to their values in the Kerr metric. Okay? And then see what those parameters turn out to be when you compare them with observations such as from these.
Thank you very much. Like a 1% or 2% level occasionally is when you see something, the multiple moments agree with those Kerr metrics you read out, are they different? But as soon as you go away from the Kerr metric, there's no horizon. And then there, and so you're talking about some other kind of object at the center, and the interaction of that other kind of object at the center presents a conundrum. That object might be a naked singularity, in which case nothing will go down it, probably. But one has to work that out. If that object were a soliton star or some other hypothetical kind of object, there would be some sort of interaction, which will not be characterizable in terms of multiple moments. And so the issue of interact with a central body is an issue that is unresolved, whereas the issue of the external space-time geometry in vacuum general relativity is clear.
That's the interesting part of this project, I think.
Right.
Well, no, I think the other interesting part is to ask yourself, can we go beyond what we have in our hands is a clear parameterization where you can ask, what are the multiple moments of the central body if general relativity is correct?
Right.
We can hold and measure these to a fraction of a percent, mass spin, mass quadrupole moment, so forth.
But is it true that your formalism will not admit a black hole with a horizon, but a different space-time geometry outside that horizon?
That the vacuum Einstein equations insist that.
No, but in some other field equations, though.
So you've got to change the field equations. And so that's the issue. The moment you change the field equation, we don't have the answer in hand.
Yes.
So I think there's two challenges to this theoretical project. One is to extend what we do have in hand on multiple moments to other theories of gravity. And the second one is to deal with, find some good way to talk about the interaction of the waves of the central body or to parameterize that.
Jim Bardeen. Right. So that's an interesting point. And that could give a set of parameters that could, in principle, be measured by, say, some future X-ray astronomy mission or whatever.
About 1.5 force field radii on the horizon in the case of a fast spinning hole. So really the entire last year of observational data is mapping out the almost immediate vicinity of the horizon. So it seems to me that your idea is a quite attractive one. That's where the data are coming from, so close to the horizon. Maybe you do that in general relativity and build up a
you're saying you get the most leverage there, you think, in the testing.
Within 1.5 particularly in a rapidly rotating case, the distance away you are is maybe a factor of 2 in R during the entire last year.
That would also be true of X-ray spectroscopy and reverberation. Rich, you had a comment.
Estimate the amplitude with any degree of would guess, I'd have to look at NLP here, because the relative amplitude of the higher end would be.
Maurice?
Yeah, the point that you emphasize is that if you change the multiple moments away from her, you might not have, or you will not have, an horizon. Of course, in this context, I think you have to add one ingredient, because the problem arises in terms of the wave interaction distance, funny surface that you will have. But of course, then you simply have to do you have to take into account the forces you're alluding to. What are the new scattering properties of the funny horizon? Well, in that case, it becomes the funny scattering properties of the funny horizon and whatever funny is in the sky. And so if you still have, that's of course the issue here, you still have a magic wave that's supposed to be not familiar with, dissipation of gravitational waves in time, and that's of course not known from QGR, then it becomes very difficult to distinguish, to say, well, between the alternative of a genuine horizon and gravitational dissipation, or a funny surface of funny dissipation in time.
Okay, Ramachandra, quick comment?
Yeah. I wanted to amplify on something that Carl was describing about ADAP solutions and event horizon. The spectral fit is not great. It's just that the model has the right qualitative features. It looks like the data. And what's interesting is that if you just did a straight thin accretion disk model for some of the low luminosity systems, it would disagree very badly. Okay, so that's the situation right now. So I think now a challenge to theorists would be, can one come up with an alternative model for some of these dim systems which doesn't have an event horizon? Is it possible to make a model which will sort of look like the spectra at the level that the ADAP models are agreeing, but without an event horizon? We have not succeeded in doing this, but I think this is something that may be a profitable exercise. And the only request I would make is that don't make these models totally arbitrary. Put a little dynamics, try to make them at some level consistent. But, you know, let's allow ourselves some latitude and see if there's a way of fitting the same data without an event horizon.
Right. I would say mass loss and non-thermal emission, the combination of those two might do it. I think we're going to have to move on. Do you want to make a comment, Carl? I think we're going to have to move on.
Just wanted to say that I think that's a really good idea. And another thing I learned about ADAP in this session was that quite a bit of the emission actually arises very deep in the gravitational well. So in principle, the information is there. So, yeah.
Yep. Right. Okay, well, that's...